From NPR, it's Latino USA. Defining a crime to fight it. Femicide, the killing of women, and the growing spotlight on the victims.
Typically, we've criminalized homicide or murder, but this definition of femicide is new in our country because we wouldn't give that much importance to the killing of women. So we're just starting to give it the focus it needs by giving it a name.
And as a boy in Havana, Isaac Delgado grew up listening to Nat King Cole and couldn't get him out of his head.
Quiero que me expliques, por favor, lo que encierra la palabra amor. Porque así podré saber.
The L-O-V-E between Isaac Delgado and Nat King Cole. That's coming up on Latino USA. I'm Katie Davis. Stay with us. Some notes now on the news of the week. On Long Island, three teenagers were sentenced to seven-year prison terms for their roles in the 2008 killing of Marcelo Lucero. Lucero, an immigrant from Ecuador, was stabbed to death by a gang of white teens. Prosecutors said he was targeted because the attackers knew many Latinos were afraid to report crimes to police because of their immigration status. In May, Jeffrey Conroy received a 25-year sentence for manslaughter as a hate crime for his role in the attack. And two other teens pleaded guilty and still face sentencing. In Mexico, 72 bodies were found at a ranch. The New York Times reported that according to a witness, the victims were migrants on their way to the United States, and they had been targeted for extortion. The scene, however, is reminiscent of several drug cartel-related killing and dumping points in northern Mexico. In May and July, authorities discovered sites of other mass murders believed to have been committed by cartels. The death toll in Mexico climbs ever closer to 30,000 people as the drug war there approaches the four-year mark. And in Chile, good news in the middle of disaster. 33 miners trapped 2,000 feet under the earth for almost 3 weeks are alive. A landslide caused a tunnel in the mine to collapse outside the northern city of Copiapó. The miners reported being hungry, but well. They asked for some toothbrushes, and supply packets can be sent down to the miners in about an hour. But in order to ensure the men don't get further trapped in the mine, progress to reach them will be slow, very slow. It could take up to 4 months before they are free. Doctors and psychologists are working on plans to ensure the miners' mental health remains strong. In Baltimore, a troubling incident, one that's reflected in other U.S. cities. Racial tensions between Latinos and African Americans are on the rise. Two recent murders of Latinos committed by African Americans spurred local leaders to hold a rally. The goal, unification and peace. But the gathering quickly turned to another hot topic, immigration. Activists called for the police and the city government to implement a written policy, stating that police will not ask residents about their immigration status. Baltimore's police chief and a city councilman both said a written policy is unnecessary. But some leaders say without an official policy, Baltimore's Latino residents won't feel comfortable cooperating with law enforcement.
When President Reagan and Attorney General Edwin Meese appeared in the White House briefing room on short notice today, no one was prepared for their surprising announcements that money from the controversial Iran arms deal was secretly funneled to the Contra rebels fighting the
Contras government of Nicaragua. May be gaining traction in Nicaragua again. Jose Gabriel Garmendia, better known as Comandante Yaob, claims he's training an armed rebellion against Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega. Ortega, a Sandinista, was voted out in 1990, but returned to the presidency in 2007. A report in the Christian Science Monitor says that the comandante has threatened his Contras will, quote, remove Ortega from office with bullets if he tries to run for re-election. The military has dismissed these threats, but some former Contras say it would be a mistake to disregard them. And finally, we remember a pioneer, a man many are calling a godfather of the Latino civil rights movement, Mario Obledo.
As co-founder of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund and the National Hispanic Bar Association, as chairman of the Rainbow Coalition, Mario Robledo has expanded opportunity for Americans of every race and ethnic background. Through the force of law and the power of the vote, he has enhanced the character and condition of America.
That was former President Clinton awarding Robledo the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor in the United States. Robledo was one of the co-founders of MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, the so-called law firm of the Latino community. Robledo was also California's Secretary of Health and Welfare under Governor Jerry Brown. Robledo died in Sacramento at the age of 78. You can stay connected to news throughout the week. Follow us on Twitter, where we're Latino USA, all one word. And you'll find news on our website all week long at latinousa.org. We'll be back in 30 seconds, so stay with us. It's Latino USA. I'm Katie Davis, filling in for Mariana Hossa, who's on vacation. Murder has different names: homicide, fratricide, infanticide, and a word now gaining use, femicide. It means the killing of a woman because she is a woman. And today we have two stories, one from Bolivia, where justice for a murdered daughter can mean taking on the military. But first, a conversation about a legal ruling this summer that is related. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit ordered an immigration judge to consider a Guatemalan woman as a, quote, separate group who could face persecution and thus qualify for asylum here. Alan Hutchinson is the lawyer who argued the case of the woman, who now lives in Reno, Nevada. Her name is Leslie Perdomo, and she and her sister came to this country after their father was murdered in Guatemala.
At the time she left Guatemala, it was the height of the Civil War, and great numbers of people were being killed by both sides, the government and the insurgents. Her mother had already left for the United States, and she and her sister Zulima made their way through Mexico up to the U.S.-Mexican border, entered the United States without inspection. Her mother filed an asylum application, listed both daughters, Leslie and Zulima, since they were under 21 and children, on her asylum application. Eventually, slowly takes years before these, you got before a judge. She got before a judge and claimed that her husband was stabbed to death in the Mercado. And they said, well, people get stabbed to death every day in the Mercado. That had no political connection, and rejected it. When the girls reached 21, they were no longer considered children, and if they wanted to continue to claim asylum, they had to file their own asylum claims, which they did. But they had to admit they did not suffer any past persecution in Guatemala for political or religious or any other reasons. But they did have a well-founded fear of going back to Guatemala because of the extremely high femicide rate, that women were being murdered, and apparently the government was doing nothing about it.
Now, tell us a little bit about that. What did they know about that high rate of murder called femicide, murder of women, and what did they know about it, and why did it make them so reluctant to go back?
Well, like most members of the Latino community in Reno, Nevada, they watch the news every evening in Spanish. And I tend to watch it, too, because there's much more information about what's going on in Central or South America than you get from the American stations. And the Spanish stations were recording this high rate of femicide, and that seemed the only available defense to them. Otherwise, they would have been removed to Guatemala almost immediately.
And when you started to make this legal argument, what, if any, evidence did you put in your brief about this threat to Leslie Perdomo and her sister?
Well, basically, we had volumes and volumes of information on femicide from the Guatemalan Human Rights Commission in Washington, D.C. Plus, as the problem grew greater, more and more international organizations recognized this. And eventually, both houses of Congress enacted resolutions directing the Assistant Secretary of State for Latin American Affairs to exercise all of his efforts to get the government of Guatemala to stop this wave of femicides.
One reaction to this ruling, which is not totally final yet, but it's a prediction, also another prediction, that many, many women would apply for asylum from Guatemala, and there would be sort of an avalanche of applications. What are your thoughts about that?
Well, that's a misconception. Basically, this decision protects the approximately 3,000 Guatemalan women presently in the United States. Most of them have been here at least 15 years, who are facing immediate removal back to Guatemala. And in my opinion, they're facing the possibility, you know, of rape, mutilation, and murder, because that's the way the femicides occur. They now have a defense.
Mr. Hutchinson, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
Alan Hutchinson is an immigration lawyer in Reno, Nevada. Let's move south now to Bolivia, where violent crimes against young women have increased dramatically. Between 2008 and 2009, cases of violence by boyfriends, husbands, and fathers went up by 10% in the capital, La Paz, alone. Almost none of these cases have faced justice or are likely to. However, a new law that is widely expected to pass before the end of this year will create a prison sentence of up to 30 years for the murder of women. Reporter Ruxandra Guidi has the story.
Patricia Brañez is a stoic and straight-talking sociologist who focuses on women in a country largely dominated by men. She's holding a cigarette with one hand and with the other, leafing through a binder full of numbers and newspaper headlines. She works for the Centro de Información y Desarrollo de la Mujer, Bolivia's largest women's rights organization. It's the only institution monitoring cases of femicide, and Brañez says those numbers have been going up steadily since 2004, year after year.
Se determina que, por ejemplo, el 2009 han habido 98 feminicidios.
In 2009 alone, there were over 98 femicides in our country, and that's just what we've counted in news reports. Since we know that many of these cases go unreported, it's more likely that there have been 150 or more incidents of femicide. On top of that, we know government institutions like the justice system don't keep track of these cases. So this really goes to show how violence against women is accepted as the norm in Bolivian society and by our government.
But why have the numbers gone up so much in the last year? Brañez doesn't have the answer, but suspects women are starting to report these cases more. She does know that the data is alarming and that there are plenty of cases in La Paz and the neighboring slum city of El Alto that illustrate this. Gladys Apaza's home is in the poor working-class neighborhood of Villa Victoria. A month ago, her father came home from work and found the 20-year-old's body and her little nephew, Fernando, laying dead next to her with another gunshot wound. Her ex-boyfriend Gary, a military officer, admitted to his family that he killed Gladys. But then he fled, and now neither his parents nor the military will reveal his whereabouts. Viviana Apaza is Gladys' mother, who's been visibly distraught by the crime since it happened.
I was selling toys at my stand downtown when I realized that I had 8 missed calls on my cell phone. Another call came in, and when I answered, it was my husband. And he said, "Gladys is dead. Milo is dead." And I almost died myself. That instant, I left everything and ran home. When I got here, our home was full of police officers, journalists, photographers. They told me to go upstairs and didn't even let me see my other kids.
Viviana Paza says she can now see the warnings she missed. Gladys had broken up with Gary in January, but he refused to accept it. He'd become extremely possessive and jealous and repeatedly asked her to hide this from others. He flaunted his military background, and he told Gladys that he couldn't commit to a girl like her from a poor family. Aside from playing these painful scenes over and over in her head, Viviana has been consumed by the fact that her family can't afford a lawyer. On the other hand, Gary's family has 4.
¿Cómo es posible que 4 abogados defiendan a un criminal?
How could it be that there are four lawyers defending a criminal, and we don't even have one? I am a poor, simple, hardworking woman, and my daughter was too. I once told Gary, there are women that would line up to be with you because you have a swagger and a uniform. There are women who are better off than my daughter. So what is it that you want from her?
Not all cases of violence against young women are motivated by jealousy and possession. But Gladys's case is certainly one of many others that have come to the attention of the Bolivian police.
Fortunately, the Bolivian police forces are doing everything in our power to investigate crimes, no matter whether the victims are rich or poor, powerful or not.
Colonel Rosario Alvarez Claros is the chief of the Crimes Division. Faced with a sharp rise in violent crimes against women, he says machismo must be to blame, and he says he believes the military does have information.
We are doing the investigations, but haven't had much success. We've contacted the military command to see whether Gary is still active or his whereabouts, but they won't comply.
Colonel Alvarez knows the family believes there's a cover-up, and he told me, quote, I think it's obvious that this is what's going on. The leadership of the Bolivian military is so powerful that no one can face up to them, not even the Ministry of Justice. But for the last 6 months, the institution has tried to address this kind of impunity by introducing a new law. It's called the Ley de Feminicidio, and it marks the first time in the history of Bolivia that gender crimes will be prosecutable by up to a 30-year sentence. Irma Campos is in the newly created gender department, and she says she hopes the new bill will not only pass and become law, but that it'll change Bolivian society.
Normalmente lo que se ha habido es el tema del homicidio como tal.
Typically, we've criminalized homicide or murder, but this definition of femicide is new in our country because we wouldn't give that much importance to the killing of women. So we're just starting to give it the focus it needs by giving it a name. Now when people hear femicide, they're starting to ask, femicide, what's that?
Most Bolivians seem puzzled by the term feminicidio in the new law, especially since no outreach programs have been designed to inform the public about the need for this law, nor its aim. Meanwhile, there are only three women's legal centers in La Paz and El Alto, with more cases of violence than they can handle. Valentina is among those cases, a poor woman in her mid-30s with a violent husband who refuses to grant her a divorce. She's come to the Women's Center to explore the possibility of a lawsuit, the only way out of her abusive marriage. Valentina says she's skeptical that a femicide law will do much to reduce society's denial of gender violence.
Just imagine how violent this man is, that my life has been risked many, many times. He could have easily already killed me, and the police wouldn't do anything. But you know what? I'm not afraid of him anymore. And he knows it. If he tries something, I will defend myself. This is the third time that I filed a complaint against him, but nothing will happen. So what do I have to do now? Pay the judge? I don't have any money. You know, laws are beautiful, but here in Bolivia, they are not applied, and they don't make a difference.
But the family whose daughter was murdered by a member of the Bolivian military plan to explore any and all justice that this law can offer. For Latino USA, I'm Ruxandra Guidi, El Alto, Bolivia.
In a minute, Cole Latinoamericano, Isaac Delgado's tribute to Nat King Cole. That's coming up on Latino USA. Stay with us. You're listening to Latino USA. I'm Katie Davis, in for Maria Hinojosa.
Dale, dale, ven conmigo a celebrar. Te voy a hacer una fiesta inolvidable, mi nena.
Take a percussive beat and an unwavering voice, and you have the music of Isaac Delgado, a blend of old and new.
Tratada como una princesa, en toda una atención de primera, voy a consentirte tanto que jamás vas a olvidarlo.
Salsa has been Isaac Delgado's passion for years. As he grew up in Cuba, and as he played throughout the world, and still now as he remakes a career in the U.S. His last two albums received multiple Grammy nominations, and now Isaac Delgado says he wants to expand his audience. And sometimes to go forward, you go back. So Isaac Delgado returned to some musical memories of his boyhood in Cuba. We have the story now from Fred Wasser.
In 2007, Isaac Delgado, his wife and two small daughters, left Cuba for the United States. Back home, there was only the occasional car passing by their house. They now live in this busy neighborhood of high-rises along Miami Beach. In many ways, life has changed dramatically since the move.
But we do have the same heat. The climate is similar. The vegetation, I can see palm trees. The colors are very similar to those in Cuba. On a personal level, I have a lot of nostalgia for my family. I have a son in Cuba.
And Isaac Delgado's mother died right before he left. His mother was the well-known Cuban singer and dancer Lina Ramirez, a regular at Havana's famed Tropicana nightclub. As Delgado remembers it, the seeds of his new project were planted by his mother. She brought home some record albums, Nat King Cole singing in Spanish. Nat King Cole actually recorded three Spanish-language albums in the late 1950s and early 60s in Havana, Rio de Janeiro, and Mexico City. Delgado says his new album, what he calls his Nat King Cole in Spanish project, started when he was a boy listening to the family record player.
Mujer, si puedes tú con Dios hablar, pregúntale si yo alguna vez te he dejado de adorar.
En mi casa, ¿no? En la casa, Nat King Cole, pues se escuchaba obviamente.
At home, we listened to the music of Nat King Cole all the time. My mother, my father loved his music. And Nat King Cole comes into my home by way of the aura that had been created after his visit to Cuba and having performed at the Tropicana.
Y tú, quién sabe por dónde andarás, quién sabe qué aventura tendrás, qué lejos estás de mí. Qué lejos estás de mí.
Wanting to record Nat King Cole's songs was one thing, making it happen another.
No era fácil porque encontrar un sello que quisiera grabar a Isaac Delgado.
It's not easy to find a record label interested in recording in Spanish Nat King Cole's music from Isaac Delgado when everybody's used to listen to me making tropical music, dancing music.
Isaac Delgado found an ally in Cuban-born producer and Latin music historian Nat Chediak at Calle 54 Records, and the Nat King Cole in Spanish project was born.
Mujer, si puedes tú con Dios hablar, pregúntale si yo alguna vez te he dejado de adorar. Y al mar, espejo de mi corazón, las veces que me ha visto llorar la perfidia de tu amor. Te he buscado donde quiera que yo voy y no te puedo hallar. ¿Para qué quiero otros besos
si tus labios no me quieren ya besar.
Singing Nat King Cole's songs posed an interesting quandary. You see, Nat King Cole did not know Spanish. Cole learned the songs phonetically, and he had an American accent. The quality of a singing voice and his charm, though, made it all okay.
La gente incluso las canciones que Nat King Cole interpretó.
Sometimes singers, when they repeat and re-record his songs, they use that accent that Nat King Cole used because he learned the songs by memory without really knowing Spanish with any depth.
Some Spanish language singers love these works of Nat King Cole so much that when they sing his songs, they mimic even his American accent. But Delgado decided not to take that approach.
I didn't want to lose track of my own way of singing the songs and handling my language.
Siempre que te pregunto que cuando, cómo y dónde, tú siempre me respondes quizás, quizás, quizás.
Nat King Cole's younger brother, Freddie Cole, a great singer of standards in his own right, agreed to sing two duets with Delgado.
You won't admit you love me, and so how am I ever to know? You always tell me, perhaps, perhaps, perhaps.
For Isaac Delgado, Nat King Cole's voice is ever present. Perhaps, he says, this is a daring project. It's hard to know whether or not it'll be good for his career in America. But he did it because he identifies with Nat King Cole.
Lo que digo ahora es que él hizo un homenaje a la música de Latinoamérica, pero a través del idioma nuestro, ¿no?
What I believe now is that he paid homage to the music and to the people of Latin America through our language. By recording these three records in Spanish, it led us to love him because we could see that he was somebody who wanted to identify with the Latin community.
Isaac Delgado's new Nat King Cole tribute album is called L-O-V-E. For Latino USA, I'm Fred Wasser.
Quiero que me expliques, por favor, lo que encierra la palabra amor, porque así podré saber si es cierto tu querer o solo es un capricho que por mí has sentido.
And for this week, that's Latino USA. We had help from Eric Haimide, our translator for Isaac Delgado, WUNC in Durham and KUNR in Reno. The program is produced by the Futuro Media Group, online at futuromediagroup.org, in association with KUT Austin. I'm Katie Davis in Washington. Mariana Hossa will be back next week, and you can join her again for the next edition of NPR's Latino USA.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age, and Lumber Liquidators, whose flooring includes pre-finish and stain, solid hardwoods, bamboo, cork, and laminates. Information at lumberliquidators.com. And from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.